Welcome to The Mentors Project, covering mentorship, books, and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a new series of books where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Today's guest is Cynthia Cooper, author of No Person Above the Law, a novel based on the life of Judge John J. Sirica, the judge from the District of Columbia who ordered President Richard Nixon to turn over his recordings of the White House conversations, a question at the heart of the Watergate scandal of the 1970s. Welcome, Cynthia.
Hello. I'm so glad to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you. This is, of course, a fascinating thing to be talking about. And my first question is always, why do you think that Judge Sirica matters to us today?
Pretty much every newspaper, podcast, website, magazine that you pick up today has some connection to or relevance to the work of Judge Sirica. Because he was a central figure in the unraveling of the Watergate scandal, some of which is now being replayed in Washington, he laid the tracks for many of the decisions, many of the actions that are underway today. So he can hardly be more relevant. You know, for his work, he was named Time Man of the Year in 1974. And while there were many people who had a hand in unraveling Watergate, he was one of the central figures, clearly.
That's fascinating. Of course, we knew that about him. But the idea of how he got involved, how did it end up in his desk, and what was the controversy involving his decision?
Well, Judge Sirica had involvement in three or four critical places in Watergate. He was the chief judge in the courts in Washington, D.C., and in the courts that handled local crime cases. So when the Watergate burglary or break-in happened in June 1972, the case came into the courts, and he had the opportunity to assign the case, so he assigned it to himself.
Oh, how fun. Now, that's fascinating. Did you find out why?
There were a couple reasons why. He actually felt very strongly about it. He was kind of a news junkie, so he'd been following it right away. Secondly, he was a Republican, and he was conservative. And, you know, he immediately deduced who is going to be breaking into and bugging the Democratic headquarters except for someone who has an interest in the other party, the Republicans.
True.
And he thought if he appointed another judge who was a Democrat, then they would be considered partisan. But as a Republican, he would not be accused of being partisan. And that came into Judge Sirica's court. Five burglars who were arrested on the scene, very unusual circumstances, and two so-called handlers. And that was his first involvement. And he was very skeptical from the beginning that they were telling the truth, and he felt very strongly that people should know what happened. The newspapers were trying to uncover things. He really wanted it to come out in court. He really wanted to hear the story. And so from the very beginning, he questioned them from the bench, which is somewhat unusual, and was asking them, who sent you there? Where did you get the money? You know, they were arrested with like consecutive $100 bills, like thousands of dollars.
I remember that. It was the follow the money before that even became a movie saying, yes.
Yeah, right. And, you know, and there were these transfers. There was a transfer of $93,000 to the account of one of the burglars. And the money, when it was traced, was to a campaign contributor.
Ooh.
That some of that stuff wasn't known then, but he knew that something was fishy. and he did not want the wool covering the eyes, particularly in the courtroom. He felt that the truth needed to come out. So he was pressuring from the very beginning, the prosecutors handling the case and also the defendants to tell what they knew. That did not happen. In fact, as all the actual burglars started pleading guilty, and so did one of the handlers, and that left only two people of the seven on trial. And when they pled guilty, he like grilled them, like, who sent them again? You know, where'd the money come from? How did this check end up in your checking account? And they, you know, basically they knew nothing. In truth, they had been paid off.
Of course.
In truth, there was hush money that was being handed out to them. But that was not public at the time. So from the judge's perspective, you know, you're trying to find out what's going on.
Did he face any kind of, you know, media persecution or even from local folks, attitudes against him trying this deeply in the situation?
He did not receive censure of any sort, but it was unusual for a judge. He questioned people from the bench, and that was an unusual tactic. And at the time, some people questioned it, and some other people commended him for it because, it, you know, stonewalling, that's where the term, you know, kind of came into public mind. Everybody was stonewalling there. And what he eventually did, the two who were, they five pled guilty, and the two who were on trial were convicted. Still very little information about what had exactly happened or who paid them, what higher-ups were involved. He had a nickname prior to that. He was quite conservative. He had a nickname prior to that of Maximum John.
Because he gave people the maximum sentence?
That's right. Ah. He was known around the courthouse for giving the maximum sentence to everybody.
Funny.
So he let the burglars know and the handlers, Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy, that he was going to sentence them to the maximum, which could be about 35 years in prison.
Because of a burglary? 35 years?
Yes, because of the break-in. That was the maximum on the charges. That they were convicted of six charges, pretty much all of them. But he would reconsider it. He found a little loophole in the law. It was called provisional sentencing. And that was controversial, where he provisionally sentenced them to the maximum. And he said he would reconsider it in 3 or 4 months. And in fact, if anybody wanted to give information or had more information they wanted to share, that might be looking their favor, going to their favor.
Oh, that's fascinating that he was able to do that. And it's legal, but it's a little interesting.
Yeah, right, exactly. And then one of them, James McCord was kind of the electronics guy. He had all the equipment and he knew how to do a lot of, you know, surveillance. He was former FBI and I think former CIA both. He wrote a letter to the judge, and he said there were higher-ups involved, that there was perjury at the trial. He mentioned some names, including John Dean, who was the White House counsel at the time.
Of course.
And, you know, John Mitchell, who the former attorney general, was the head of the campaign. So he named a few names and he told what he could. And that was kind of the first break in terms of the public understanding of Watergate. Around that same time, John Dean, the White House counsel, started realizing that this whole series of nefarious activities, which, as I mentioned, involved throwing evidence in the river and burning evidence in a fireplace and obstruction of justice and working out a special deal with the head of the FBI to get information about what the prosecution was doing and passing around cash from hidden White House safes. He got the idea, the impression that he was going to be blamed for it all.
Oh.
That may have been correct. So he started talking too. And those were the two things that kind of broke open that stonewalling, that put some little drill holes into the stone. And so that was Judge Sirica's first involvement. But it continued after that because the House and the Senate were getting involved, and in both hearings about what had happened in Watergate and also in terms of impeachment inquiry. And so there was a special prosecutor got named, and, you know, things were continuing. And one of the things that happened is, of course, they wanted John Dean to talk to the Senate investigators headed by Senator Sam Ervin. And John Dean had actually quite an incredible memory. He could remember dates and lots of details.
And that probably had come in handy in his previous career in a way that they didn't assume would be against them now.
Yeah, yeah. And so when he was testifying, he talked about his various conversations directly with Nixon as well as with his aides, Haldeman and Ehrlichman. And he said that he thought in one conversation they had in the executive office building, and Nixon was acting very strange, and he went over to a corner and whispered something, and he said he had the feeling they were being taped, but he didn't know. So then, you know, as those hearings went on, it became a question of, was John Dean telling the truth, even though, you know, he'd previously lied and admitted it and had pled guilty to it, or was President Nixon telling the truth? Because President Nixon said he had no involvement, he knew nothing about it. He'd never talked to anybody about Watergate. He'd never ordered anybody to do anything, which is what John Dean had said he had done. And so there came a time when they interviewed one of the officers who worked in the White House by the name of Alexander Butterfield. And they asked him sort of offhand, is there a taping system in the White House? And he said, yes.
And there had been. There had been since like FDR, right?
I don't know about if there had been, but there had been an extensive one that Nixon had installed.
Interesting.
That was the taping equipment was actually drilled into his desk. It was also on all the telephones, except for maybe one or two in the personal area. And it was in the president's quarters in the executive office building, which is separate from the White House.
More extensive than even I had read. That's interesting.
Yeah. So then it became a question of, well, how are we going to answer this question? There's a way to answer this question. Who's telling the truth, the president or John Dean? And it was after that they realized there was one tape that was really incriminating. Now, previously, there had been tapes that were missing of the originals that were ordered, and then there was the 18-and-a-half-minute gap on one.
Exactly, the accidental erasure.
Right, and that the information about that came out in Judge Sirica's courtroom as well. He held a special hearing on that. What had happened to the tape? And Rosemary Woods testified that she had done it accidentally by, you know, answering the telephone and in trying to demonstrate how, you know,
she couldn't do it.
Right. An acrobatic move. But beyond that, the judge sent them out to be analyzed by technical experts, and they came back and said they had been erased 5 times. So it wasn't just an accidental erasure by Rosemary Woods.
How funny. They didn't trust it. They went over it 5 different times to make sure it was surely empty.
Right.
Wow. That's just an amazing story for one man to encounter in his career. So we need to talk about how he came to this career and why you think he was so moved to want to see the truth come out. What was it about his childhood? What was it about his person? How was he formed? Who were his parents? And what makes him that kind of man? What did you think about his childhood?
He had a very hard scrabble kind of childhood. His parents were pretty poor. His father was a barber, but he undertook various small businesses, running a restaurant or a pool hall. And they ended up traveling around the country a lot. So he had kind of an itinerant childhood. We never lived in any place very long until they moved to Washington, D.C. when he was about 14. And he hadn't really even gone to school at that point because they weren't living in places really long enough. He went to some high school and college. His father was a big influence, and his parents wanted him to get an education. They didn't want him to have the life they had had.
And they were immigrants, right? Or children of immigrants?
His father was an immigrant. His father immigrated when he was a child to Waterbury, Connecticut. His mother's parents were immigrants around the same time period. Judge Sirica was born in 1904. So we're talking about in the early 1920, around in there, 1920. Judge Sirica had a job when he was young as a newsboy.
Well, how cute, like in Newsies, of course.
But he was kind of a news junkie, and it started with that, you know, calling out the headlines and And then, you know, he found in D.C. that people were pretty avid for the news. So he made his living doing that while he was in high school and thereafter. And so he became, that was kind of his form of education, was reading the news.
And he also was. I was going to say, but somehow then he got himself into an actual formal high school slash college.
So here was one of the interesting things about Judge Sirica. He did go to high school. He went to, they actually sent him, got him into a private high school. He never went to college. He went from high school to law school, which people could do at that time. And it was around World War I. They were eager to have people in law school. It wasn't everywhere in the country, but in D.C. it was possible. And he had a cousin who was going to law school and said, come on, come with me. So he went, but he went and he dropped out, and he went again and he dropped out. And then he went a third time and he made it through.
Were the dropouts due to finances, or he had to work so he was too busy to do the sort of schooling he needed, or?
He felt overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. You know, he was overwhelmed by, he was, because he hadn't gone to college, he didn't have the background information. He didn't, there was a lot of Latin. Law school was very formal. The professors were kind of mean. It was a lot of reading, and he couldn't handle it. He says that, you know, it just was, the information would swim in his head. He was terrified. He was insecure. So when he was called upon to answer, he got, you know, all messed up. So just purely because he didn't think he had what it took. And finally his parents, like, you know, were so disappointed in him and so upset that he might end up being a barber like his father or something like that, that he just kind of, the third time he went in, he was going to do it. He was going to finish.
He was truly motivated.
The other thing that was interesting about Judge Sirica is he was a boxer. And around that time, the way he made his way through law school was by teaching boxing and by teaching calisthenics and at the Y and at the Knights of Columbus. And that's how he kind of got a lot of his education, is from the men that he met that he was teaching.
So in conversation with them as he was working with them.
Right. Huh. And they liked him. He became very friendly with a man named Leo Rover, who was a U.S. attorney, you know, kept encouraging him, you know, you got to stick with it and, you know, you got to meet people and you got to talk to people and it's the relationships you form there that are going to be the most important. And you know how to box, you just have to, like, you know, do it there. You have to be tough. And so he did do that. He kind of toughed his way through law school. He had a very eclectic and difficult career after law school, though, as well. He was scrambling as a criminal defense attorney and barely getting by. And finally, Leo Rover, the same gentleman, had an opportunity to appoint someone, and he felt like John Sirica had matured and had shown what he could do in court and was, you know, standing up and talking, and that he would make a good addition to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia. So he hired him there.
Wow. In the heart of the Depression.
Yes, right. That's why it was so hard for defense attorneys. Both, you know, most of the cases coming in were prohibition cases, and most of the people didn't have any money to pay. So, you know, he was really scrambling, and that was his first good job, and it didn't last that long. It only lasted that for a few years until Roosevelt got elected. And so it turned over from being a Republican office to a Democratic office. But another interesting thing that happened to him, he went back into private practice, and again, he was still scrambling. But he was getting a little bit of a name around the courthouse as a courthouse, you know, attorney and someone who could handle cases, and he was handling local cases. So a committee needed a lawyer, the FCC committee, and they had his name, as a replacement for their counsel, and they brought him in to investigate some corruption within the FCC. He worked very hard on that, and he did the investigation, and he felt like he had great evidence that he was going to present before the committee. And they announced that they were going to close the hearings, and so that the hearings weren't going to be public, and so the results would not be known. And this is kind of where you see the mettle of the man that became Judge Sirica. He thought that was so wrong. He thought that there was corruption, that there was fraud, and there were payoffs, and that it was all going to be hidden. It was all going to be swept under the rug. So he quit. He resigned, and did it in a very public, the last public hearing. He announced that he was resigning. He said he was resigning because the hearings were going to be made private. The information would not be released to the public, and he was not going to be part of that. So you see, he had this very deep feeling about people who tried to corrupt the law in some way or another. And I think that did come from being an immigrant and his father being an immigrant. He had this reverence for the constitutional system and the idea that everybody had to obey the law. And it didn't matter if you were rich or you were poor, if you were a government official, or if you were charged with murder, if you were charged with a prohibition crime. You had to, obeyed the law, and the law was to treat everybody equally. So that was what he took into, emotionally, into the Watergate hearings.
I think that's quite brilliant, because it does seem to come from a childhood of not seeing, justice and fairness happening to the people around him. And wanting and finally getting to a position where you could provide that and having the opportunity must have been a beautiful feeling for him.
He really wanted to be a judge, and he lobbied for it and campaigned for it. And finally, an opportunity came up when Eisenhower was president, and he was nominated. He had to be nominated. And it's a lifetime position, by the way. So he got that, and it was the thing he wanted the most, I think, was to be a judge, and to, a judge is the one who's making the decisions in the courtroom and who has the authority and the power. And he really saw that and wanted to be a person who could wield that.
So now tell me from a writing standpoint, because these novels are, they're fictional versions of people's lives. We have a lot of good material to go on, but in the end, we're allowed to be fictional a little. So is there a scene that you wrote because you needed to connect some dots, or you wanted to work with some characters? Was there a very fun scene that you wrote that you really enjoyed?
I'm going to answer your fun scene question second and say first that I worked really hard to make all of the Watergate information absolutely accurate. And I did a lot of work at the Library of Congress, which is where Judge Sirica's papers are. And there's, of course, massive information about Watergate. But I felt that it was just too important to fictionalize. The only things that might be fictionalized is it might come out in a conversation as opposed to a legal document.
To make it more readable, more interesting to a, yeah,
right.
Exactly.
But in terms of the facts, who, what, where, when, why, it's all, I'd say, pretty tight. The scene I liked the most, in Washington, I went to the courthouse where Judge Sirica worked. And I went to look at the courtroom where the burglary trial took place and also the tape hearings were held. It was a special large courtroom. So the very first scene, although it goes back to its childhood, the very first scene is as the burglary trial is opening. And I just kind of felt, because I'd been there, and I felt like it expressed like the magnitude of it, and also Judge Sirica's sense that he was going to do the best possible, that this had been, he was 68 at the time, and that this was kind of a culmination of all of the things that he had learned in his life, whether it was boxing, being a criminal defense lawyer, being in the attorney general's office, handling the FCC hearings. Here he had all this accumulated experience. he had this case that needed somebody to be tough or to be, you know, willing to try and get the truth out. And he was determined to get the truth out in his courtroom. So that's I think that's probably the scene I am most drawn to.
And how did you dramatize that?
Well, it's mostly in a conversation with his clerk, who's a real person named Todd Christensen. You know, where his clerk is looking out into the courtroom and telling him how many people have come in and who the court reporters are and that there are sketch artists there. And he's putting on his robe and kind of reflecting on how, you know, what he learned as a boxer, holding your body and having a strong constitution, which is not only
physical,
in his body, but yeah, in his feelings about the U.S. Constitution.
Oh, I love that.
And again, you know, Nixon, they did not expect Judge Sirica. I think that was one thing they didn't count on. Because he was a Republican, and he had actually campaigned, before he was in office, he had campaigned for Nixon as a vice president, you know, the Eisenhower-Nixon ticket. And so they thought Judge Sirica would be in their corner. And Judge Sirica was in the corner of the law. He was in the corner of the Constitution and the truth. And he didn't care if it implicated higher-ups, and even if it implicated Nixon, who he admired. Nixon, you know, ran on this, on the motto of law and order. Judge Sirica really believed that. He not only, you know, it was not only a slogan for him, it was a reality. Law and order was so important. He always believed, which I think is a little bit unusual, he believed that the higher up someone was and the more education they had and the more influence they had, the more responsible they were, and that they should be held not to a lower standard but to a higher standard, because they had to know that what they were doing was wrong or immoral or illegal and anti-democratic. One of the surprising things that emerged, he actually believed Nixon after he resigned and then a month later Ford pardoned him. He believed Nixon should have been tried and should have gone to prison. President Nixon, this is something that's coming up now, but very recently people are looking at again. President Nixon, when the cover-up case came forward, and that was Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and Dean, and a few others, and the grand jury released an indictment, there was an unindicted co-conspirator, and that was President Nixon. President Nixon, had he not been president, would have been charged in that case criminally. And Judge Sirica, among other people, but Judge Sirica believed that when he was no longer president, he should have been tried criminally for his actions, which were truly despicable. I mean, hush money, raising money to pay off witnesses, encouraging people to commit perjury, you know, obstruction of justice, using the departments of the government to advance his own interests. No, that would have been a criminal trial. And again, you know, you have a conservative judge who just believed that everybody had to hew to the same legal standard, and that if Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and Dean were going to be tried, then so should their co-conspirator, President Nixon. And just recently, people started looking up this indictment information, because when the grand jury indicted the co-conspirators on the cover-up case, so Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and Dean, they handed over a suitcase, two suitcases of information to Judge Sirica, and asked him to lock it up in his safe for them. And then the special prosecutor, who at that time had different powers than the special prosecutor now, the special prosecutor, Leon Jaworski, filed a motion asking the judge to deliver that to the House impeachment inquiry. And Judge Sirica wrote an opinion and decided that that was appropriate. And all this material, which was was delivered to the House impeachment inquiry, the difference that it made is it was already organized. They'd already pulled out the who said what, you know, right. Item one, you know, hush money. Nixon said this, so-and-so said this, the money was transferred here, the money was transferred there, you know, so-and-so agreed to be silent for that reason. So it was all organized in file folders by the special prosecutor, and through that legal maneuver was handed over to the House Judiciary Committee, which at the time people believed had the only power to take action against Nixon, which was impeachment. So he had Judge Sirica, you know, as you can see, was deeply involved in a lot of the actions that allowed Watergate to be unraveled, or to allow the misdeeds of Watergate to be ended. And, you know, for that reason, that was the reason it was named Time Man of the Year in 1974. There were a lot of people doing a lot of great things around Watergate, but he had such a pivotal role in making sure that the truth, that was, he kept saying that, he wanted the truth to come out.
Beautiful. And he did. He used his power to make that happen.
It's really like when someone stands up to be the tallest they can be, you know, when they realize that maybe they might be the last stop on the
the
train.
It's what everyone says about Lincoln, that right man in the right place at the right time.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And one other little fact about Judge Sirica, he was the first Italian American appointed to a federal judiciary
in the whole country. Wow.
Yeah. So he was the first federal judge who was of Italian American descent.
Oh, that's beautiful. Did that ever get in his way, his Italian and or Catholic connections? Did they cause him issues along the way early in his career?
I think as a young man, he saw his father being abused for being Italian. You know, people trying to take advantage of him or call him names. And there was also one point where after he got a job as attorney general, assistant attorney general, it was the first time he had some income. So he bought his parents a home, helped them buy a home in D.C. But the contractor tried to cancel the contract because real estate developers, salespersons told them that they couldn't sell if there were Italians.
So it's a housing covenant.
There was no covenant. People said they didn't want to sell. The real estate brokers said they didn't want to. They couldn't sell property in this development if it was going to be, you know, if Italians were going to be there.
So how did Sirica get around it?
And so he went over there. Judge Sirica went, and this is a scene I dramatized, went over and talked to the developer and said, you know, show me. Show me where it is, and, you know, I'm not afraid to go to court. And by the way, I work at the U.S. Attorney's Office. This is not related to the U.S. Attorney's Office, but I think this is wrong. And how can you cancel the contract? Where does it say in here you can cancel the contract? Because some real estate broker doesn't want to work in the area. So it
how
got
wonderful.
Reversed.
That's using the education that your parents helped you get to help them.
Oh,
that's
right,
so beautiful. Exactly. All right. Well, I'm going to end on two questions. The first one is, and you've kind of touched on this already, but who would you say was Judge Sirica's mentor?
Right. I think there are a couple people. One is Leo Rovner, who I mentioned, who was a U.S. attorney and had become a student or someone he worked with as a boxer in, you know, training. And another was another lawyer who took him on by the name of Bert Emerson, who gave him his first job, basically just gave him a desk in the corner of the reception area and kind of let him follow him around and pick up cases where they needed to be. But that's where he kind of learned how to be a lawyer, which you don't really learn in law school.
It's like an apprenticeship. You need to have that.
Exactly. And then another direction, he became very close to Jack Dempsey. And he and Jack Dempsey kind of became friends over some business opportunity in Washington, D.C. And they became very, very close friends. And Jack Dempsey was a bit older, and a bit more worldly. And Judge Sirica started traveling around with him at one point and selling U.S. bonds. And then whenever he would feel down, Judge Sirica would feel down, Jack Dempsey was the one who would say, come on, you know, you're going to do this. You're great. You know, I believe in you, and you got to believe in yourself. So Jack Dempsey became kind of his emotional coach.
That's so wonderful. What a cool idea to think about those two men together who don't seem like they have anything in common. So who did he mentor?
Judge Sirica became involved as a founding member of something called the Lido Club in D.C., which was a group of Italian-Americans, men, that gathered to promote a more favorable image of Italian-Americans. So he was a very young lawyer there. He became the president at a very early age, and he was connected to them in ways that he could be throughout his entire career, so less so as a judge, but more as an attorney. But then, you know, they honored him. He was their, you know, big honoree at their 50-year anniversary. And a part of his involvement with the Lido Club was with a scholarship committee. He really wanted to get scholarships to other kids like him who came from impoverished families, who came as immigrants or as children of immigrants and needed some help with their education. So I think that was his biggest, you know, way of mentoring other people.
That means my last question then is going to be, who has been your mentor in life?
Well, I have to mention two people, but one was my high school journalism teacher, who was by the name of Anna Nunnemaker, and I think she saved me from juvenile delinquency and all kinds of trouble by believing in me as a writer. And the other one was a woman I was fortunate enough to work for with by the name of Justice Rosalie Wall, who was in Minnesota. She was the first woman justice on the Minnesota Supreme Court, and an amazing woman who had a great deal of compassion and empathy and moral acuity, and imparted that to the people around her with just, you know, her support and generosity. And I think also taught me that judges are people, and, you know, they have good days and bad days and emotions, and they're part of the general culture, and that you have to see a judge as a whole person and as someone who, you know, is really deeply connected to some kind of moral value.
Oh, I deeply agree. That's a brilliant thing to say, and it ties right back into that seems to be the man that Judge Sirica was.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
I mean, exactly.
Well, thank you so much for sitting down with us and talking about Judge Sirica today, Cynthia.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for asking.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.